Purple Space Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash OBE, with guest Samantha Renk, presenter, disability consultant, and author.
I feel as if I have known Sam Renk forever, but the actuality was that I probably met her around 6 years ago when I was chair on the judging panel for the UK's SureTrust Power 100 list, and we were at the launch event, the announcement event. And I watched Sam in the corner of the room, and she was surrounded by some incredible individuals, and she was captivating in that she was speaking unflinchingly about the challenges that we face as we navigate sometimes an inhospitable world. But she was very practical. She was talking about some of the things that she does and encourages others to do about navigating challenge. And as I say, I was transfixed. I was captivated. So I got to speak to her in this wonderful conversation, which I hope you enjoy. So in terms of introducing Sam, Sam was born with a rare genetic condition, one that we commonly know as brittle bones disease. She's a full-time wheelchair user, and she talks about her career journey in this conversation with me. She started her career as a teacher. She is now a regular face on our TV screens. She is a writer. She is a broadcaster. She's a keynote speaker at great events. She's a disability consultant, and she's also ambassador for Scope. During lockdown, Sam wrote her first book, The Best Thing Since Sliced Bread, a brilliant book. And one of the many lines that chimed for me was, we must be unapologetically imperfect. So she talks what I call obstinacity, a mashup of words and mixing up obstinance and tenacity. And she does this in moments where she doubted her ability to succeed. You will enjoy that. So in our conversation, you will hear Sam, who initially rejected the idea of networking with other people with disabilities before later discovering the life-changing benefits from being able to learn from the direct experiences of other disabled people. She talks about putting the hard graft in to find career stability, and the journey of inner confidence that she has developed throughout that time and continues to do, as we all do. Her journey to finding ways of being consistent in her personal brand, and also asking for openly and unapologetically for the things that she needs in terms of the workplace adjustments that she might need or accommodations. It's beautiful stuff. So I know that you will enjoy this. These interviews, Confident Conversations, interviews that I'm creating for Purple Space are brought to you with the thanks to remarkable individuals who are choosing to share their learning about inner confidence so that others can learn faster. Once you have listened, I ask one thing of you, and that is to pass it on to five other individuals who you think might be in a position to enjoy the learning and who will then cascade to five others. We're on a mission at Purple Space to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence, which is a strong expectation of a positive outcome, and to share the practical things that we can do to create and navigate our working worlds while managing disability and all the things that comes with that. So enjoy this film. We're on a mission at Purple Space to make, I suppose, the content of these podcasts really relevant to anyone who experiences any type of disability, any age of onset, whether it's mental ill health, neurodivergence, you know, whatever people are experiencing as they tune into this podcast. Our belief is that our interviewees will have those golden nuggets. We're sifting for gold around the things that you have learnt in order to, I suppose, self-regulate, navigate life, navigate other people's stuff and pity, etc. So what for you would be those kind of enduring childhood truths that you dismantle, that you say no to? You know, what would be those couple of lessons?
I think ultimately it's how you value your life. And I don't mean to sound dramatic. Yeah. You know, yeah. I lost a parent when I was 9. My dad died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage. And I think, irrespective of my disability, that was a sobering moment, because he was 38. And that's no, you know, that's no life. That's a child, practically.
Yeah.
And so I think I've always carried that with me, in the sense of, well, you know, people underestimated me. People said no, shouldn't, couldn't, wouldn't, you know, all these harmful tropes, all these negative stereotypes that are associated with a person's ability when they're neurodivergent or, you know, deaf or disabled, you know. So I guess that, ironically, out of that really bad situation, you know, the loss of a parent, that gave me a bit of a kick up the derriere to be like, well, no, life is sacred. I've seen firsthand how quickly things can turn on a dime, you know. So I think I sat there and I kind of reevaluated, even at that young age, like, well, what do I want from life and how do I view my life? But it's interesting. I literally watched a video the other night on social media, and this person was on a flight, and they got up on a flight and they started like dancing and videoing themselves doing this little dance. And I read the comments because I was intrigued, because that is like the biggest sense of like confidence, isn't it?
Yeah. What,
people might say arrogance. I mean, it is what it is. And I read the comments, and a couple of comments stood out to me, and it made me realize how far I'd personally come in my own journey. And a few people said, I would, you know, basically sell my soul for an ounce of that confidence that person has. And I guess I would be more of the person that would get up and dance on a plane. You know what I mean? I'm definitely that person now. So, you know, in preparation of us talking, you know, I thought I'd bring that up because I actually thought a lot about my own journey. That's not to say that, you know, I haven't really struggled. I think, you know, when you're at high school, kids can be cruel. I absolutely, you know, experienced that. I think my sister gave me although it pains me deeply, no, I'm only joking, that she comes out with all these pearls of wisdom. But that's, I guess, what older sisters are there for, aren't they? But I remember at one time I was really battling with my body image. I was at college. All my friends had boyfriends. I had boys that were friends who kind of flirted with me, but then would never do it in front of other people. Or, you know, I had one person go, yeah, well, we can go out, but just don't tell anyone. Or, you know, so I was bombarded, you know, as an adolescent with, you're not good enough, you know, like, and it was, I guess it's strange because I know I'm good enough. Like, I know I've got so much to offer. You know, I know that when I walk into a room or roll into a room, like, people stop and there, not just because I'm in a wheelchair, because I radiate something, you know, I'm a people person. I have that innate skill. So I kind of was getting all these mixed messages, and ultimately, you know, hormones flying and just not being supported. I really struggled with mental health. And one day I went out and I remember being really low and I didn't want to go anywhere, but my mum and my sister dragged me to IKEA. Good old IKEA, because, you know, what better thing to do on a Sunday, hey? And I remember just being, I suppose, from the outside, just looking like a moody teenager. But I was hurting inside. I was hurting because I think I spent a lot of my childhood changing who I was to get validated. And when I was at college, it was an opportunity to, you know, wear the clothes I wanted, to experiment with makeup, experiment with my hair, you know, like, you have all this freedom. And I, you know, I'm a good dresser. I love makeup, my hair, like, I was pretty, you know. But even though I did all these things, I still didn't get the validation that I wanted. So I think that's when it hit me. I was like, what do I need to do? How much more do I need to give?
Yeah.
For you to want me, for you to love me, what do I need to do? And I had that moment of, there'll be nothing. I can go on and I can go on and I can go on, and you'll still not love me because all you're seeing is a wheelchair. So I think I was really low. Anyway, back to IKEA. I remember at the time I was going through wearing lipsticks at that phase. So I had this bright red lipstick on at that time. And everybody was staring at me. And when I say everybody, if you are physically disabled and you or a wheelchair user, you'll know firsthand that, you know, you can't leave the house without people looking at you. You know, it is what it is. People stare, people do it slyly, people do it overtly. And I just broke down, and I broke down in the car park of IKEA. And I had a meltdown. I think I'd reached my max. And my sister knelt down to me, and my sister was very much a sporty, I mean, beautiful, very athletic young woman. But she was, you know, polar opposite to me in the sense of I was a bit of a fashionista, and she was, you know, like trackies and, you know, like hanging out with all the boys kind of thing, bit of a tomboy. And she knelt down to me. She went, "Have you ever wondered that, you know, people are staring at you because they like your lipstick or the fact that your outfit is immaculately put together? You know, have you ever thought about that?" And I hadn't, in all honesty.
Is so powerful, Sam. Yeah. I'm just pausing.
Yeah.
How clever, astute of your sister.
Yeah.
So how did you react?
I mean, I think at the time I didn't, because it's my older annoying sister giving me a nice piece of advice that actually makes sense. So I think I didn't really take it on board to begin with, because I was like, death to anything my sister says. Yeah. You know, you do when you're, but I think over the years, I carry that with me. And I have that, I call it a bit of a swapperoo. I change how I view things. And the irony is, like, once I started doing that, yes, there's still going to be nasty people out there who are just ignorant, who want to try and sneak a photo of you because they think it's funny and send it to their mates. I'm not saying that's appropriate or that's horrible, and, you know, these things happen. But actually, it's really funny because now,
Sam,
when people...
I'm going to jump in. I know the listeners will still be listening to the impact of the story you've just shared. So I just want to sit with it for a moment, because you prompt me, you remind me of being a teenager myself. I remember when I first acquired JCA Juvenile Chronic, it came, I mean, obviously couldn't walk very far and walked with a wobble and, you know, severely impaired in terms of how I walked and looked, etc. And I red rash, I mean, it was a disease that affected many aspects of life. And I remember getting ready for a disco at school, and I was trying to look glam, and I had this coat on that my cousin Brenda had given me, and I was trying to look as gorgeous as I could be. And I remember my dad, as I left, I remember leaving the house, and Dad said to me, "Kate, you look so lovely. If you were not my daughter, I would really wish that you were my daughter."
Aww.
Now, the reason I share that in relation to you wearing lipstick and yours, because I think sometimes we do, as you say, internalize the, you know, the pity and the oppression and the, you know, the curiosity and the inquisitiveness of others. But if we overdo that, we also forget to enjoy and receive the good stuff that comes from individuals. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And I, you know, and I practice that, you know, sometimes when I'm having, even now I have my moments where, you know, I think the pandemic triggered a lot of, you know, apathy for our own personal well-being, I guess, you know, and I definitely slipped into that. And the past few months, I got my mojo back, in the sense I was like, I'm going to dig out that hat that I've not worn in a while. And I remember this one, I had took a week off work not long back. And I literally, every single day I went out, but even if I just went for coffee, I went full, just went full. I remember this, I also remember, like, this woman, I went across the zebra crossing, and this woman, she went, fabulous. Like this. I know. And then I think the next day, you know, I did it again in a different outfit. And then the next day, someone stopped me and went, "Hi, I'm one of them. I don't know why I'm doing an American accent, but let's go with it. Hi, I'm one of those influencers, and I take pictures of, like, beautiful people. Can I take your picture for my?" So that happened, and you know, this woman jogged past me and then she jogged back to say, I love your outfit. And I think, you know, we need to cherish those moments and we need to remind ourselves of those moments. This is actually why I really like, you know, social media for all its woes. Sometimes what I do when I'm definitely, you know, kind of flagging and I don't feel my, you know, tip top self, I actually go back through the archives. And I look, and it's not about looking at, oh, that was a great interview, or this was, just look, oh, that was, I wore that outfit, or, oh, I met up with that person for a coffee, or, oh, I wrote that post, and that really resonated with, like, so many people, you know, and I think it can be, and it doesn't have to be social media, it can be even just writing in a diary or something, just your accomplishments, and I'm not talking about huge accomplishments. I'm just talking about accomplishments that are important to you. And I guess when it comes to, you know, radiating that confidence, it's like you have to do things for yourself. I think people smell.
I'm going to jump in again. Yeah. I'm going to jump in. Lots of richness here. I'm going to move on to your career now. In preparation for our conversation, I reread your book. Yeah, so this is You Are the Best Thing Since Sliced Bread. So for those of you who are tuning in, get it, okay? Yeah. Read it, or purchase several copies and have a little book club with your employee resource group. So, but Sam, for me, you have an interesting career. And as I say, there's some beautiful golden nuggets in that book that everyone should read. I like many of your lines. One that really chimed with me is your line that we must be unapologetically imperfect. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Unapologetically imperfect. So my question is about your career. Did you know where you were heading when you started your career? Was there ever a moment, you know, you shared some really important and powerful things that you've held about yourself, but was there a moment when you doubted your ability to succeed? Because the thing that comes through in our discussions, your book, everything that I watch and learn about you is your tenacity, your determination. I call it obstinacity. Yeah, it's a mashup of obstinance and determination. So my question is, did you know when you were where you were heading with your career? Was there a moment that you doubted your ability to succeed?
So, first question, no, I didn't know where I was heading with my career. So I knew I needed to go into higher education. That was instilled for me from a young age. And it's funny, I remember at age 7, I was like, yes, I need to go to college, and then I need to go to university. And then, you know, so I had that vision. I knew that was the path. And I followed that. But at university, I had quite a big operation, and that put the spanner in the works a little bit on my focus and what I expected and where I was going to be, and it just kind of threw me off a little bit. And I also at the time, you know, I wasn't very independent as a young adult. I wasn't very independent. I had quite a codependent relationship with my mother, which is quite common. And, you know, I felt a bit stifled at times. I felt like I didn't have my own identity or independence. So although I was doing all the right things to get my career, I probably was, I doubted myself because all the bits behind the scenes weren't, you know, in place. So I went into teaching, and I purely went into teaching because someone said it's another year in education. And if you are disabled, you know, being in education, believe it or not, it's a nice safety bubble. There's a lot you can get from it, not only personally, but safeguarding wise. You know, there's a lot that you can, it's great. I encourage anybody to stick at that as long as possible, because, you know, being an adult sucks sometimes. I'm not going to lie, like adulting is like horrendous. Anyway, I digress. So I did the teacher training because I it was another year in that bubble of education. But also I got a grant. I got a grant and I would be earning some money. So I kind of tentatively went into the world of teaching. I was great. I mean, the kids loved me. Some of the teachers didn't love me because I think the kids love me too much, you know what I mean? So I think there was a bit of friction there. But I love the positive impact that I had on that space. Not only for the children, but also for the other kids in the class that were disabled themselves or neurodivergent, I think having a strong role model as a disabled teacher was wonderful. But it just wasn't, it wasn't where I wanted to be. And when I, you know, I quit that job and I moved to London, I was actually volunteering as a trustee. And that's where I found my, yes, this is good. This is, I like this. Not only had I connected with other disabled people, because to be quite honest, most of my childhood and teenage years and young adulthood was spent rejecting any other disabled person. Because even though I'd found my inner confidence, I was like, I'm pretty cool. I quite like me most of the time, but other disabled people, because I had internalized everything I'd kind of grown up with. And I'm not ashamed to say that, because it was part of my learning. And then when I became a trustee for the Brittle Bone Society, and I was there for 6 years, I learned a lot, not only in to do with PR work and working with the media and working in a charity sector, but also I was submerged with all these other people that kind of looked like me and had similar experiences, and I was like, wow, I'd been missing out, like this is like amazing. And it's interesting, isn't it? And I know I'm digressing a little bit, but when I was struggling at college, a counselor said to me, all the advice she gave to me was, Why don't you seek out other disabled people? Why don't you seek out other... And I remember being enraged by that suggestion. I was like, how dare you? I don't want to be associated with them, you know? Hindsight's a funny one, because actually what she was saying, even though at the time I was incredibly defensive and I let my ego get in the way, what she was saying was right. Anyway, fast forward, I love charity work. I love being a trustee, but you don't get paid for that. So I was like, okay, I found my niche. I want to be help people. I did night courses, I did counselling courses and things. I really got into that world of care and nurturing and being that role model and being that person that, you know, people could come to openly and having that approach. And then I moved to London and I just couldn't get a job. I experienced what I would say was out and out disablism.
Yeah.
For the first time. I really felt it. And I was like, oh wow, I'm going to job interviews and, you know, the lift is broken, or I'm sat in a job interview and they're literally looking like a deer in headlight thinking, oh my God, I don't want to employ a disabled person, but I know I'm not allowed to say that, you know, and you're just sat there. And a lot of disabled people, we're all very intuitive. We all can read through the lines. And I fell into acting, and I loved it to begin with. I fell into it, you know, by haphazardly. I went to a housewarming party. There was a lot of media people there. I met someone whose house it was. They worked in production. I think I was the first disabled person they'd really met. I know that sounds, you know, like really met. And I think they became quite enamored of me, and they loved what I was about. And we, you know, we did a film. I got an agent. And as I say, you know, the rest is history. But I, even now, you know, I doubt myself all the time. And I think the problem is, and I think I've come to the conclusion, yes, I am inherently quite a worrisome person, but I think the problem with disability and why we always doubt ourselves so much is because the stakes are so high when we lose. And what I mean by that is I say yes to every opportunity because I get bored easily. That's the truth, right? But the other truth is I am terrified of not having enough money to pay for my wheelchair when it gets broken, to pay for extra care and support, to lose my independence. Yeah. Well, that the independence that I work so blinking hard for, really work hard for. And I think this is where my comfort, this is why my confidence, every time I do something, I went on a TV show. And essentially, I'm not going to say which one it was, but it's a really high profile show. And it was amazing that they asked me on as a guest. And I think there was like, you know, whispers in the background. Is she going to be a new panelist? You know, and I went into that And it was a chat show. And I, as you can tell, I can chat for, you know, I can chat for England. Like, this is what I do. This is what I like doing. This is what I feel comfortable doing. And I remember being on that chat show, and I wouldn't say I crumbled, but by gosh,
Why did you crumble?
Because I knew it wasn't, in my mind's eye, it wasn't just about being on that that appearance at one time. This could mean security, stability.
Yeah, not you.
And I'd put so much pressure on myself.
Yeah.
And I'd self-sabotaged in a way. I put so much pressure on myself because it wasn't just about don't swear when you're live on TV. Like for a lot of people, that would be the biggest concern, wouldn't it? You know, like, go on there, smile, say what you have to say, and make sure you don't say the F word. You know what I mean? Like, for most people, that would be the biggest thing. For me, in the back of my head, I was like, this could mean more support time. This could mean blah, blah, blah. This could mean, and that's sad. And I'm working on that even now, because I'm trying to be a bit more zen about things. I'm trying to be a bit more, you know, be in the moment, don't think too much in the future. But it's difficult when you have a disability, because we have to think about the future, you know.
I really get that. That will have a lot of resonance with listeners, you know, Sam. You know, our community, it comprised, you know, we reach 1.5 million employees with disability within the business community, public sector, NGO sector, those that are in work. And what you've described, even though their experiences of disability may be altogether different, there is a real thread that runs through our lives, and that is the necessity to feel safe and secure in our financial freedom.
Yeah.
And our ability to have economic independence. Yeah. You know, there's wonderful statistics from Scope about the extra costs of disability, which are very, very real. So what you're sharing is you were really vested in securing that role, and therefore almost self-sabotaged, as you said, because it meant so much to you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back to how maybe friends or family, not necessarily intentionally, but, you know, that internalized ableism. So, you know, if you're not, I strove to be independent. That was my biggest goal. But it was more to be independent because I was sick of me being made to feel like a burden from others. Like, oh, you know, who's going to look after Sam? And, oh, well, she can't do that on her own. And, oh, you know, and I was like, well, sod it. I'm going to go and, you know, I'm sick of that, because that's not fair. And I think, you know, in more recent years, and I say years, maybe only in the last 6 months, I've set boundaries more when people have made me feel that way. Like, I would never challenge someone if they made, like, a really ableist microaggression or said something, you know?
Give us an example and what you would say differently now.
Yeah. I mean, so I even, you know, I had a conversation with my mum the other day. I've got two cats. And I alluded, like, I would love to have more animals. And she went, oh, you know, she went, don't get another animal, because it's more work for other people, you know, because obviously I do need some support. And I would normally go away and feel really, really upset. I would probably be really passive aggressive. I'd probably not speak to her properly, or, you know, show, you know, act quite childish about it and internalize it and get really mad. And, you know, feel rubbish. And that, but I actually, you know, stepped out, and then I went back and I said, actually, that comment really upset me. I said, I'm very capable of looking after, you know, pets. Yes, but now and again, I do need help. And I got a very sincere apology. And that was the first time that I probably got, you know, would get that interaction. But I'd normally be too scared to confront that. And I think what I kind of tell people now, particularly when I'm doing training for non-disabled clients and partners, I say, stop putting this projecting this image that disabled people are the only people that need help or support. Ask yourself, when was the last time you went to your GP, your gynecologist? When was the last time you stopped a stranger in the street for directions? When was the last time you picked up the phone to your best friend, your sister, your brother, your mother, and had a rant and had a rave? So why is it?
Help.
Yeah, why is it? It's always us that are the drain, you know, of emotional drain or physical drain. It's like, no, it's so false and it's so damaging.
Yeah. Sam, I'm going to jump in. It's all good stuff. So look, we I want to sift for gold in what you shared. Sifting for gold. So we, as you know, we've launched a series of guides, Confident Conversations, and the purpose of the podcast, you know, we're going to be interviewing, like you, the most extraordinary individuals who have used their experiences to find ways of navigating life differently. Yeah. Yes. You know, like a stick of rock, if you snap, you or I, the social model of disability, the words run through us. But even with that, we still know that we have to do some jobs of work ourselves to build our inner confidence and our resilience, as you're describing that story with your mum. Oh, it's a takeaway. So my question is, so we've created this basic suite of resources. They touch on what we call the six fundamentals and the six hurdles when building inner confidence. Which one of each of those has real meaning for you? I mean, you've talked about networking with disabled people. That might be the one. I don't know. But what has real meaning for you in the fundamentals of building inner confidence?
I think so. I'm actually bringing them up now because I've got the... I actually really enjoyed reading all of it. A lot of it. Really, yeah. Like resonated with me. I think a combination of everything, but I think when I speak to a lot of young disabled people, I guess they fell into a trap sometimes of thinking that, particularly after, you know, Black Lives Matter movement and all this really positive DE&I, so inclusion talk, and it was all really great things. But I think what came away from that was a lot of, again, from my own interactions with disabled people, purely online and socializing like that, you know, they thought that their disability was the key to getting success. So now, you know, the world should be listening and they should be giving me opportunities because of my disability, because you can't discriminate against me. And of course there is an element of truth behind that, because no one deserves to be discriminated. That's why we've got the law, that's why we have the Equality Act, and that's why we are protecting one another. And of course we should be setting boundaries, and of course we should be using our voice to say, hang on a minute, I found that a bit ableist, or hang on a minute, that doesn't sit right with me, or hang on a minute, do you know that, you know, my rights are X, Y, and Z, or so on and so forth. But I think there just became this little bit of I deserve this because of my disability. And I think for me, that might be your foot through the door, but hard work is always going to be hard work. So I guess I guess that would lean into your, you know, your sixth hurdle. So being overconfident, perhaps, or, you know, not anticipating those inevitable setbacks, I guess. Yeah. I guess it would be a combination of those two, in the sense of, you know, you have to have something about you. You know, you have to. This is why I struggle with, you know, aspiring to other people. Yes, have role models, but actually, when you're looking at someone, you're like, well, I want what they want, but I want what they have. You know, I'm on Instagram. Why have they got that? I want that. It's like, but that was their dream. That was their goals. Think about, get back to basics and go, well, what's your dream? What's your goal? And I've experienced this when I stepped a little bit back from acting. And I loved acting at the time. It was great, but I wasn't getting where I wanted to be in the time scale that I needed to, you know, to progress and succeed. So I kind of like, I said, right, what else am I good at? I'm good at talking. I'm good at communicating. I like public speaking. I like writing. Let's do all these other things. And it's really interesting because a lot of people are like, oh, it's a shame you don't do acting anymore. Or why have you dropped? Like, they see that as a big failure. On my part, I'm like, no, that wasn't a big failure. Like, it's okay to dip your toe into things and go, actually, even though I really liked that, I know that I might want to try other things. So I think there's a couple of takeaways there. You know, don't expect to get opportunities fall into your lap, because things don't work like that. Of course you can network, of course you can, you know, put yourself out there, but you need to be consistent in what you do in order to have that longevity, you know.
You know that expression, it takes a lifetime to be an overnight success.
Yeah, well, and I think this is another thing. So I've, you know, I was living in London for 12 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worked really hard on my career. And I would say it took me eight years of that 12 to get any financial stability, notoriety, or my own internal confidence. You know, it took me about 8 years. And I think sometimes people don't, and maybe this is where we go wrong because of social media. Maybe we need to not just talk about successes and failures, but also talk about the graft.
Yeah.
The graft behind it. Because I don't think a lot of people saw the graft, but, you know, saw my mental health decline at the beginning and everything, saw the rejection, saw, you know, what I sacrificed, saw that inner turmoil. That's why I write about it quite a lot in the book. You know, I talk about, you know, my ego getting in the way sometimes. And I think that's maybe what we need to touch upon. So don't rest on your laurels. Is that the right expression?
Yes, totally. Yeah. Very powerful, Sam. Very powerful. Ooh. We could be here till midnight. You have got all day. I'm joking. Look, my next question, I'm just, you know, you shared your childhood. You shared a bit about where you are now and the graft to find that, you know, relative stability in your career. You know, it continues to flourish. So my question is, as you look back to that young Sam, you know, going into teaching, etc. So as that young Sam set on her career, what would you now say to her? What would you warn her against? And what would you encourage her to hear in relation to the joy? You know, the funny stuff, the ironic, the perverse, the naughty, the sassy. You know, what would you warn her? What would you say hang on in there about?
Hang on in there. I think doing my postgrad, so my PGCEs to become a teacher, I found that really challenging. And it was really interesting because I'd just done 4 years of a BA, and then, you know, which is heavy going in itself. And then I went to do the postgrad, and I found it really, really hard. And I really gave myself a hard time. And I think one of the bit of advice is, you know, stop being so harsh on yourself.
Yeah.
That's the big thing. But also, I think I had a really interesting experience when I applied to university. I did a language degree, and because I wasn't very independent, I kind of limited where I would choose to go to university. So I essentially, what I did, I looked on the map and I went boom, boom, boom. There are the four closest options, right? Who do what I need to do.
Yeah.
And I went for all my pre-interviews and all that, as you do. And I went to my local university and I said I wanted to do this course, and I had the grades and I, you know, had the knowledge. And they said, well, because it's a language degree, you'll have to automatically do a year abroad. So it's called an Erasmus year. And I was aware of that, but you got to understand, at this time, I could barely make a cup of tea myself. You know, like that, that's where my life was in terms of independence. Or I was fine in the academic setting, but in everything else, I couldn't drive. I didn't go out on my own. I didn't make my own meals. I was heavily relying on external help, which is all fine. That's where I was. And I remember trying to explain to them that that's probably not going to be possible, where are you going to find an accessible, you know, in my mind, it's like, well, good luck finding an accessible apartment in the middle of, you know, France or Germany, you know what I mean? Like, I knew that the UK was lead at that time, that was the UK was well ahead of, you know, any other country. So in your mind, you think rationally, you think like, I'm explaining my situation, it's up to you now to accommodate my needs. And essentially what they said was, well, no, then you can't do the course. And I was heartbroken, Because you can just see things like being taken away, like, you know, just slowly taken away. I eventually went to a different university, Lancaster University, which is a wonderful university. Just received an outstanding alumni award from them. So that was really nice. Went back to see them not that long ago. But I explained the situation to them. Now, even though that, and they said, well, we can work with it. You don't need to do the year abroad. The degree that we'll give you is slight, the wording will be slightly tweaked, which again is a little bit off, but it's better than saying no, you know, a blanket no. Yeah. And I didn't do the year abroad. I actually had a spinal operation halfway through my degree, which left me with spinal cord damage. I was really unwell. All my classmates went on the year abroad. I had that year out to recover. When I came back, and we finished my degree, I got a 2-1, and I got, there was three people that had got a distinction in my year, and I was one of the three people. And yes, this is me gloating, but also I think what I would always remind myself is never accept no for an answer.
Yeah.
I think that is the biggest, that is the bit, and I think when you're disabled, you hear the word no a lot. And it's easy for me to say because I didn't challenge the other university. You know, and it worked out fine because I actually went to a much better university. They were much more accommodating and I've got really strong connections with them. And I feel really part of that community, you know, so I'm proud to be part of that university. Things might have looked very different, but I guess I would want people to stand up for themselves in these circumstances and go and challenge that person. Challenge the institution.
Sam, it never goes away, does it? Because although we're slightly older than you, but nonetheless, we've both grown up with the world getting more used to the Equality Act. And I suppose in this setting, it's, you know, lots of listeners will be reflecting on their success in securing a workplace adjustment or an accommodation. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're describing, is that ability that we have to state our need pure and simple.
Yeah.
And to, I suppose, encourage other people who have a role to play in our success, whether that's educational success or work success, to be able to deliver against that adjustment or not. It's hard, isn't it? Because even with the legislation, we still have to be confident to ask.
You know, and you know what? This doesn't mean that you need to become a lawyer overnight. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I sometimes still now, even in the work that I do, I sometimes sit there and I say to myself, Samantha, you probably should know this a little bit more in and out. Like, you should probably know the legislation a bit more in and out. You know, I think I've got a basic, you know, good sound understanding, but sometimes I wish I'd armed myself with the skills to but you know, I had a recent issue with a local authority and I got a friend involved who they are a lawyer. They weren't representing me as a lawyer, but they definitely were there as a person to lean on. So I think if you don't feel comfortable, lean on people. Don't let your own you know, lack of knowledge, if you want to call it that, or your lack of confidence in being able to educate yourself, or your ability to educate yourself, because we're not all in that situation. You know, we don't learn these things at school, do we? We kind of just go, get thrown in the deep end, don't we? It's like, here, write this, you know, here, this is how you claim for benefits, go away and write this. It's like terrifying, you know?
And again, Sam, it's in our Confident Conversation series, one of the fundamentals is to do your homework about workplace adjustments. We might wish our employer sometimes to automatically know all of the ways by which they can accommodate our need, whether it's different software or ergonomic mouse or, you know, or a soft adjustment to allow us to be off on a Friday afternoon to access one of the talking therapies. We might wish our employer to know all of that, but let's face it, that's not how the world works, and we have to do our homework.
We have to, but I think it needs to be I think there needs to be a bit of onus taken on the other side as well. Oops. Because you've got to understand that for a lot of disabled people, myself included, speaking up or kind of challenging the status quo, if you will, is scary and it can be triggering, yeah. You know, and you don't want to be seen different. You don't want to put yourself in a position. So when I say to a lot of my clients who are allies, you know, I often say you need to leave your ego at the door. So if someone like me comes and goes, hang on a minute, that's not right. I'm not attacking you. You know, I'm not attacking you. I just want what's best for me, you know?
Yeah, love it. Ooh, right, look, we are on the home straight here. We're on our last question, can you believe it? So, Sam, like many, many podcast series, we too build in a closing tradition of asking the previous guest to ask the next guest a question about the role and the value of building inner confidence. So we've got a question for you. And that is, how do you react to pity? Does that red lipstick come on? Or how do you react to pity live and in the moment? Do you let it go? Do you ignore it? Do you work around it? Do you get the lipstick on? How do you do it?
I think it varies from how I'm feeling, whether... Yeah. I literally if I've had a heavy week at work, I might be less inclined to call it out or entertain it, or you know, if it's that time in the month, let's be real, my hormones go everywhere and I can absolutely crumble, you know, I can sit there and go, oh my goodness, woe is me, that was so embarrassing. And if I'm on top form, if I have that emotional cup, it's full, as I call it, then I definitely do the sassy, you know, I will talk to people. I don't think I will ever call them out. I think I love the expression, kill them with kindness. And I think how often, or why maybe I'm so approachable, or why maybe I don't get into confrontations, even if I feel discriminated against, is because I don't go in like a bull. I go in with quite a level head. I go in with the kill them with kindness approach. I read a book years and years ago, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And you know, that's a great book. I mean, it's a bit heavy going, but it's a great book. And that all resonated with me. Like, you're going to get people to help you if you're kind and treat them with kindness, even if they may have done something that is hurtful to you in that moment. You know, if you can rise above it and if you can be that bigger person, I think it's beneficial for you. And actually, I think it's a learning opportunity for the other individual. However, having said that, like I said, depending on your emotional cup, you know, it's not up to you to educate somebody or to challenge somebody, and it can be quite intimidating, particularly if you're on your own. So I think in answer to the question, which was a great question, it depends on where I am, who I'm with, what my emotional and mental state is like. But if I feel capable, I always take the kindness approach. That's not condoning behavior approach.
Yeah.
That is just coming at it, because I don't care about I don't care about their emotional state. I care about my emotional state. So I'm safeguarding me. If I can smile at them and make them feel a little bit crappy for being so rude to me, and I'm the bigger person, I walk away feeling better. You know, if they walk away kind of feeling like, oh gosh, maybe I should change the way I approach things, that's a byproduct. It's a great byproduct, but it's a byproduct. I am the person that I need to look after and safeguard ultimately. And that's how I approach every situation.
What a way to end. I need to lie down in a dark room. That is so profound, Sam. I know our listeners will love that and apply that. Really, 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 yeah. Wow. Sam, a joy. We do not spend enough time together, but look, I watch and just enjoy the waves that you make and the ways in which you are changing this world. Of course, as I say, we work primarily within the community of individuals who have paid employment and want to hang on to that and navigate the working world. But equally, they bring their might and their muscle and their intellect and their influence to support change within the working world, and some of your tips and tricks and flicks and persona, and it's just beautiful, and I know all our listeners will learn from that. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing your story so candidly, so unflinchingly, with humour, and looking good, kid. I love it.
Yeah, well, looking good. I'm sat in a very cold freezing room at the moment, so as long as I'm not chattering, and my nails are terrible, but you didn't see that. I need to get a manicure. We should definitely work together in the future, because I love the ethos of all that you do, and I really you know, you inspire me yourself, so thank you.
Back at you. So Sam, as we close and we end this podcast, as we say, we pay it forward. If you could just jot down right now a couple of one key question that you would like to ask the next interviewee.
I'm going to be a complete youngster and write it on my phone, bring up my notes.
Love it.
I've got too many in my mind.
Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neurodivergence. Notice the fundamentals. Remember the hurdles. Take individual action. For more information, visit our website, www.purplespace.org. Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neuro-